a sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rehm, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on November 3, 1985, in the series This Is Our Father's World, entitled Alienation and Homecoming. The texts for the sermon are Genesis 4, verse 6, and Luke 15, verses 20 and 28. Copyright, Grand Valley State University.
This is our Father's world, and we can rest us in that thought. And these messages from the opening chapters of Genesis are meant to affirm that truth and to enable us to be at home in God's world, to know that God indeed has created all things, and that He has redeemed us, and therefore we can be at home and at peace in this our Father's world. But all is not well in our Father's world. All is not right. Something is desperately wrong. Perhaps the single word that can sum it up best is the word alienation. Alienation between creator and creature, between creature and creature, between creature and creation. Alienation all about. Alienation enough to go around. Alienation whose broad stroke brushes all of us at one time or another. So that there is isolation, estrangement, and anger that devours us and consumes us, and that has changed the garden of paradise into hell on earth. Alienation all about in this our Father's world. And the third chapter of Genesis, which we looked at last week, was intended to say to us that the fault for that alienation does not lie in the Creator. It does not lie in the creation per se. That alienation stems from our own hearts, we who have been endowed with such a precious and fearful gift of freedom, freedom by which we could cling to the Creator and live in communion with Him, which is His intention, or deny that relationship and live in alienation from Him to our disaster. Neither God's fault nor creation's fault. It is our fault. We are responsible because we are free, so richly endowed with a gift, but a gift used with such tragic consequences because we fail to follow the intention of our Father. Chapter 4 is another episode, another story, not a continuing history, as I said last week, for these are not stories of a primeval history. These are stories which are signs, the prelude to redemptive history, the introduction to that salvation history in the line of Israel. These are those classic chapters that speak to the universal human condition, deal with universal human concerns, answer those profound, fundamental questions about the nature of God and of human existence and human history in the world. And in this fourth chapter, we know it so well, it's so familiar to us. Cain kills his brother Abel, and so the lesson is, of course, that one ought not to murder his brother. But if that were the intention of that chapter, then it could be dealt with more economically than this whole long story. So maybe, even though it's a familiar story, maybe we've never heard the story. Why is this story, chapter 4, in these opening episodes which lay the foundation for all the rest of Scripture? What is God telling us? Adam and Eve had two sons. Cain was a farmer and Abel was a herdsman. Perhaps it's an ancient story that stems from that ancient conflict between farmers and herdsmen, cowboys and ranchers. that out of that conflict we have the setting for the story, which goes on to tell us that both of these boys worshiped God. Cain, being a farmer, brought of the produce of the soil, and Abel, being a herdsman, brought of the produce of his flock. And then the story tells us that Abel and his sacrifice were accepted, and Cain and his sacrifice were not accepted. And if we stay with the story, that's all the story tells us. One was accepted, one was rejected. The trouble with old familiar stories like this is that our mind begins to run, and we go to the letter to the Hebrews, and there we learn that Abel was accepted because he mixed his sacrifice with faith. But we must know that the writer to the Hebrew added that to the story. He didn't find it in the story. And the one who wrote the first letter of John says that Cain was of the evil one and did wrong, and Abel did that which was right. But the writer of that letter added it to the story. The story doesn't say that. If we stick with the story tells us there were two boys, one named Cain and one named Abel. One brought of his produce, and his offering was not accepted, and one other brought of his produce, and his offering found favor with God. Now, the Bible commentators have had a field day with that passage, because they too have needed to speculate as to why the one was accepted and the other rejected, because the last thing in the world a Bible commentator would want to leave us with is the idea that God could be capriciously free and perhaps even unfair. I mean, if there's anything we want to do to our dying breath, it is to protect God. And so we will fabricate all kinds of elaborate speculative theories as to the one was accepted and the one wasn't accepted, in order to protect God from the idea that maybe he was arbitrary or capricious in his accepting of one and his rejecting of another. But maybe God was capriciously free. At least maybe the story was trying to say that, at least from a human perspective, that's the way it seems to be in life. Maybe that story is in there because it's trying to acknowledge what seems to be so evidently true once we reflect for a moment. Life is not fair after all. Things don't come out even. There's no essential equity. I mean, why does one child have all the brains and the other child have none? Why has one child all the looks and the other homely as a hedge fence? How come some people can work and work and work and be faithful and obedient and careful and come up empty, and others careless? And maybe ruthless, and lacking all seriousness, and yet seem to have everything fall into place. When you stop to think about it, life is not fair, is it? Life really is not fair, and there does seem to be a kind of capriciousness about it, a kind of an arbitrariness about it, and maybe God is involved in it. At least you've got a point somewhere, and if you are a Hebrew who thinks concretely and ascribes everything to God, then if things don't fall out right, then God's involved. This is not a story about two boys who have an argument and one kills the other. This is a story about two boys and God. This is about two brothers and God. There's a triangle here, and God has his hand in it, according to this story. So, Cain's angry, and his countenance falls. Well, haven't you ever been angry? Haven't you ever felt the inequity of it all? Haven't you ever been stung with the fact that when you had done your best, the roof caved in and the bottom fell out anyway? Haven't you ever stood and observed how some silly, careless fool seemed to live always in the spotlight of God's favor? I mean, when you really begin to observe life, the psalmist said, "I'm sure God is good to the upright, but as for me, my feet had almost slipped when I looked at the prosperity of the wicked. And I said to myself, you know, I've kept my heart clean in vain." Life is unfair, folks. And when you come up on the short end of the stick, when you've done your best, when you've done what you thought was expected of you and required of you, and when you've given it your all, and it still didn't fall out right, haven't you ever been angry? Well, now we're approaching the crisis of this drama. God comes to Cain and he says, "Why are you angry?" Nice going, God. Keep needling. "Why are you angry? Why is your countenance fallen? If you do right, won't you be accepted?" Literally in the Hebrew, if you do right, you can lift your head up. But if you do wrong, sin is crouching like a lion or a demon at the door, ready to devour you. But you must master it. Now there you have the crisis point. Hey, Cain, what are you going to do with your anger? What are you going to do with your anger, Cain? Life isn't fair, huh? Who said it was? You angry, Cain? What are you going to do now? If you do right, Cain, you can lift your head up high. If you do wrong, Cain, there's a demon crouching at the door ready to spring on you, and that old sin is such a powerful force that it will consume you and bind you up and make you its slave forever until it drives you to your death. But you must muster it. Apparently, Genesis 4 doesn't follow Genesis 3 in terms of the fact that now here's Cain, the son of Adam and Eve, who is the victim of some original sin, and therefore he finds himself unable to choose the right. It would seem at this point that the voice of God says to him, "Cain, you are on the spot. Cain, this is the moment in which your destiny will be settled. Cain, what are you going to do with your anger? Life isn't fair. You're really hurting. You're raging inside. Cain, what are you going to do? You're going to let it go? You're going to let it go? Let me tell you, Cain, if you let it go, you will be consumed. Because sin is a powerful force, but you can muster it. And right now, Cain, it's up to you." Well, have you ever been there? Have you ever experienced the crisis that Cain was going through at that moment? Raging within, countenance fallen, depressed, angry. Life was not fair. God was not fair. Hating Abel, who was accepted for no conceivable reason that Cain could figure out, while he was rejected for no conceivable reason that he could figure out. On the spot, Cain. What are you going to do with your anger, Cain? And the story tells us that he said to Abel, "Let's go out in the field." And they went out in the field and he murdered his brother. He decided to let his anger have its way. He decided to let the rage that that seethe in his breast find expression. And the rest of the story details the tragedy that ensued on that wrong act, that wrong response to the crisis of the situation when he was confronted with the fact that life was not fair and yet he was being called on to be right. And we probably won't do much more with the story, but it is a tragic tale. Cain becomes a tragic figure, even though there is a touch of grace at the end. But it seems to me that maybe that's why that story's in there, in order that you and I might also face up to the realization that life is not fair and that we carry around a lot of baggage, a lot of unresolved anger because life isn't fair, and we may not have the courage to explode at God about it all, but we may create a lot of havoc in human relationships, and we may live bitterly and cynically, stewing in our own beer over the bad deal that life has dealt to us. What are you going to do with your anger, Cain? I'm going to murder my brother. That's what I'm going to do. It seems deeply written in us somehow that life has a kind of essential fairness to it, a kind of a tit for tat. Most of us operate on the basis that if you work hard and keep your nose clean, that things will fall into place. And if you're careless and reckless, that you will reap the whirlwind. We sort of operate on that kind of a balance. But it's not really true, you know. It doesn't really work out that way. Not when you begin to think about it. Not when you begin to reflect on your own experience and the experience of those around you. Life isn't fair and things don't kind of fall into place. And they don't usually work out happily ever after either. James Fowler in his book Stages of Faith talks about the development of faith, and he says in the child from ages about 6 to 10, there is a development of this kind of essential sense of fairness of life, of reciprocity. Do good and get the reward. Do evil and get the punishment. But life isn't really that way. It doesn't really work out that way. Oh, sometimes it does, but there are enough exceptions to say that we can't just generalize and say that's the way it's going to be. And yet we kind of believe that. And that's sort of the way we deal with God, too. And that's what religion is. The peril of religion is always the peril of falling into legalism, into a kind of works righteousness. God, I've been good, now bless me. I've worked hard, I've been faithful, I've been obedient. Why has everything come up empty? We get angry at God because somehow or other we think that God deals with us like a trader or a bargainer, that we can somehow negotiate a bargain, a labor contract, if you will. And you know, it just doesn't work. God is above all of our bargaining, and He transcends all of our little deals. And Cain had to face the fact that there seemed to be a kind of an arbitrary rejection. And then it was whether or not he would still be who he was, be who he was called to be, and find himself in humble submission to the God who had created him, or whether he would rebel and say, nuts, not on your life, which of course is the choice he made. Perhaps you've seen the film Amadeus, the story of Mozart, but not really the story of Mozart. Mozart is almost incidental to the story of Salieri, the Italian composer. Salieri was achieving his fame and realizing his life dream when Mozart came on the scene and all Europe began to talk about Mozart's pure genius. And Salieri didn't know quite what to think until he met Mozart, and then he could see that he was no one to be taken seriously because he was a reckless, foolish, obscene, crude, lewd young man that obviously would never be blessed of God. And so Salieri lost some of his sense of threat and his fear and settled down somewhat until he heard the music of Mozart, and he knew that this careless, obscene, silly, crude, lewd young man had the gift of genius. Salieri had made a deal with God. Salieri, just like all of us, making a deal with God. Keep your nose clean, work hard, be obedient, do the best you can, and certainly God is obligated to bless you. He tells about his early childhood when he says, "I wanted fame. Not to deceive you, I wanted to blaze like a comet across the firmament of Europe, yet only in one special way, music, absolute music. A note of music is either right or wrong, absolutely. Not even time can alter that. Music is God's art. Already when I was 10, a spray of sounded notes would make me dizzy almost to falling. By 12, I was stumbling about under the poplar trees, humming my arias and anthems to the Lord. My desire was to join all the composers who had celebrated his glory through all the long Italian past." And so he would go to church in his little village, and there he saw in the painting that was flaking off the wall a painting of God. And he said the tradesman put him there. He was the God whose eyes were the eyes of a bargainer. And so the night before he left his village for the last time, he went into the church and he looked up into those bargainer's eyes. And he said, "You give me so. The eyes that said, 'You give me so, I'll give you so, no more, no less.' And I went to see him, and I made a bargain with him myself. I was a sober 16, filled with a desperate sense of right. I knelt before God, the God of bargains, and I prayed through the moldering plaster with all my soul. 'Signore, let me be a composer. Grant me sufficient fame to enjoy it. In return, I will live with virtue. I will strive to better the lot of my fellows, and I will honor you with music, much music, all the days of my life.' As I said amen, I saw his eyes flare, and he said, 'Bene, go forth, Antonio, serve me and mankind, and you will be blessed.' And I said, 'Grazie, I am your servant for life.' Well, he went on his way, and it would seem that subsequent events confirmed that indeed he had struck a bargain with God. And he did achieve those positions that he was looking for, and some measure of fame. He was the court composer in the Austrian court of Joseph II. But it was at that time that the fame of Mozart began to drift through the court, and one day Mozart appeared. And as I said, to begin with, he didn't take him seriously until he heard Mozart's music. And when he heard Mozart's music, he knew that Mozart was the composer that he'd always longed to be. He knew that Mozart had the gift of absolute music, of absolute genius. And the thing that he could not believe, the thing that he could not ever reconcile, the thing that he could not accept was the fact that Mozart was this careless, obscene, lewd young man who seemed to have no serious thought at all in the world, where he had been faithful and virtuous and hardworking and had slaved and longed to fulfill his obsession. And finally, when he realized that Mozart was the magic flute of God and that God was speaking through Mozart as he would never speak through him, Salieri, he said, "Now for the first time, I feel my emptiness as Adam felt his nakedness. Tonight at an inn somewhere in the city stands a giggling child who can put on paper without actually setting down his billiard cue casual notes which turn my most considered ones into lifeless scratches. Grazia, You gave me the desire to serve you, which most men do not have. Then saw to it the service was shameful in the eyes of the server. Grazia. You gave me the desire to praise you, which most men do not feel. Then made me mute. Grazia. You put in me perception of the incomparable, which most men never know. Then ensured that I would know myself forever mediocre. Why? What is my fault? Until this day I pursued virtue with rigor. I have labored long hours to relieve my fellow men. I have worked and worked the talents you allowed me. You know how hard I've worked, solely that in the end, in the practice of the art which alone makes the world comprehensible to me, I might hear your voice. And now I do hear it. And it says only one name, Mozart. Spiteful, sniggering, conceited, infantine Mozart, who has never worked one minute to help another man. Filthy talking Mozart with his silly wife. Him you have chosen to be your sole conduct, and my only reward, my sublime privilege, is to be the sole man alive in this time who shall clearly recognize your incarnation. Grazia. So be it. From this time we are enemies, you and I. I'll not accept it from you, do you hear? They say God is not mocked. I tell you, man is not mocked. I am not mocked. They say the Spirit bloweth where it listeth. I tell you, no, it must list where virtue is or not blow at all. You are the enemy. I name you tonight. And this I swear to my last breath. I shall block you on earth as I am able. So, you see, Salieri learned that God doesn't make bargains. And God doesn't necessarily bless virtue. And God is free to use whomever he will in any way that he will. And life isn't fair. And sometimes one can work hard and do one's best and strive and strive and strive some more and come up with mediocrity when some other silly fool without trying is a genius gifted of the gods. And then what do you do with your anger? Then what do you do with your anger? Then you're at the point of crisis. Then you can give vent to your rage. Then you can turn bitter and cynical. Then you can murder your brother. Or you can master it and you can let it go and you can recognize that God calls us to love him for himself and not for what he can do in us or through us or for us. You can humble yourself before God and love him for his own sake and be whatever you can be, knowing that whatever you are and whatever fame or success or lack of it isn't really important, that the only important thing is to love him and trust him and serve him with whatever gifts one has, trusting where one cannot understand. There was another father who had two sons, and one went out and squandered his father's riches on riotous living and came to himself and came home. And the father embraced him and restored him. And the elder brother came in from the field in the midst of the party and said, "What's going on?" And the servant said, "Your brother is back and your father's throwing a party for him." And the elder brother was angry. Never had left home. Never missed a day in the field. Cared for the flocks and the herds and harvested the crops. And looked after the father's welfare all these years. And now the scamp comes home and there's a party. It isn't fair. Why? Why for him? Why not for me? Son, come home. I won't. All I have is yours. I love you. I will not go in. And the story isn't ended because that story was not yet through, but I can tell you how the story ended if Jesus had ended it. The son didn't go in. He killed the father. Because sin crouches at the door ready to consume us the moment we give place. The father's always there saying, "I never said it was fair. I never struck any bargains. But I love you. Let it go. And come home."